Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. The first thing I'm going to report is from the Arizona Legal Studies. It's a discussion paper called Underwater and Not Walking Away: Shame, Fear, and the Social Management of the Housing Crisis by Brent T. White from the University of Arizona, James E. Rogers College of Law. He says, despite reports that homeowners are increasingly walking away from their mortgages, most homeowners continue to make their payments even when they are significantly underwater. The article he wrote suggests that most homeowners choose not to strategically default as a result of two emotional forces. One, the desire to avoid the shame and the guilt of foreclosure, and two, exaggerated anxiety over foreclosure's perceived consequences. The emotional constraints are actively cultivated by the government and other social control agents in order to encourage homeowners to follow social and moral norms related to the honoring of financial obligations, and to ignore market and legal norms under which strategic default might be both viable and the wisest financial decision. Norms governing homeowner behavior stand in sharp contrast to norms governing lenders who seek to maximize profits or minimize losses, irrespective of concerns of morality or social responsibility. This norm's asymmetry leads to distributional inequalities in which individual homeowners shoulder a disproportionate burden from the housing collapse. This is a fascinating article because it does discuss how an individual is different from a corporation, which is an entity that has its own set of rules, but that in fact humans have the same set of rules, but there's an overlay of guilt and shame that is actually emphasized by the entities that don't have those same psychological constraints. And as a result, people suffer in the face of debt, like in a foreclosure situation, from this psychological overlay when it actually goes against the legal norms and the market norms to deal with debt. And as a bankruptcy attorney, I find this to be a major issue when dealing with people who are holding on to a huge guilt trip about being in debt and dealing with it, even according to the law. Part of educating a client is to get them to see that they, in effect, are no different than the corporation with which they dealt to get the debt in the first place. And if that corporation was under the same insolvency circumstances, there would be no guilt at all and no shame about using the law to their benefit. It's a good point to think about. Now, an article from Max Gardner, The Deepening Unemployment Crisis. Michelle Walker lost her job working for a rental management company in Pittsburgh in the spring of 2008. She had held a job for the past 21 years and figured that she, her husband, and her adult son would be fine until she could find work again. Back then, I even thought about getting a part-time job and cutting back, she says, sighing. But then her husband was laid off, followed by her son. Her and her husband's unemployment checks did not meet their fixed expenses, And so they spent their savings over the course of the next 2 years, drawing down their 401k plans and even dropping their health insurance. This spring, the checks stopped coming entirely. Their situation became more dire and they started cutting back, turning off the air conditioning and heat, keeping most lights off, and even selling their laptop to use the computer at the library to cut back on the cable bill. Walker has contemplated selling their house, once a dream, and now a burden, with the gutters needing to be replaced and the bushes needing to be cut, so they can move in with family in Ohio. No matter how many resumes Walker sent out, no matter how many businesses she visited, dozens a month, she says, she never managed to find another permanent position. For now, she is selling homemade birthday cakes and other baked goods for cash, advertising by word of mouth and church flyer. Much of the coverage of the June labor market report released last week focused on the drop in the unemployment rate from 9.7 to 9.5%, or the 83,000 private sector jobs created. But the headline numbers hid the reason for the dip in unemployment. Not more jobs, but fewer workers. Walker, like the 652,000 others across the country, is jobless and has not looked for a position during the past 4 months, and therefore has officially been reclassified as a, quote, discouraged, end quote, worker, a person marginally attached to the workforce rather than an unemployed one. I'll start looking again when things turn up, she says, and my husband is still looking. Both of us are willing to do just about any job at this point. These discouraged workers are part of a broad and troubling phenomenon. During the past 4 months of the year, 1.7 million workers flooded the job market, heartened by good economic news. But in the past 2 months, as the recovery has faltered, nearly a million workers have fallen back out. The overarching story of the size of the labor market during the recession is no more encouraging. Increases in the size of the United States population mean the labor force should have expanded by around 3.5 million workers during the 30 months between the start of the recession and last month. Instead, it has lost 128,000 people. Those 3.6 million, the ones who didn't enter the workforce and the ones who left it, make up a class of missing workers, people who in better economic times would be producing goods and services and contributing to the United States economy. Now, they do not even show up in the official counts of the unemployed and employed. The June employment numbers give a glimpse into who the discouraged workers are. Between May and June, the labor force declined in every category, young and old, male and female, black and white, Hispanic and Asian. But some demographic groups suffered particular harm. For every 35 men who dropped out of the labor force in June, 65 women did. Black workers were 33% of the dropouts, though they make up just 11.6% of the labor force. Additionally, the number of people in the labor force in June with college degrees increased slightly, while the numbers without college or high school diplomas declined. The people hit hardest, though, were young workers aged between 16 to 24. They made up 44.5% of the June decline, though they comprise only 13.5% of the labor force overall. Those young workers, who suffer from the highest unemployment rate out of any demographic group, particularly for young black men, also tend to suffer from the worst effects from periods of unemployment. The long-term impact on these discouraged workers may be worse than simply a temporary spell of unemployment. Long periods of joblessness tend to leave workers, particularly young ones, with permanent scars, lower incomes in the future, and more trouble finding work for years. The long-term unemployed often find it harder to get work in good labor markets as well. They lose their skills and confidence and often have trouble switching from shrinking industries into growing ones. Like all members of the long-term unemployed, they tend to suffer from more depression, health issues, and even relationship troubles and divorce due to the financial, personal, and emotional stress of joblessness. At the same time that the ranks of the discouraged and missing are growing, Congress is at an impasse in reauthorizing federally extended unemployment benefits, with Republicans insisting that the spending not increase the deficit. Some have even argued that overgenerous benefits, the average unemployment check is about $310 per week, spoil workers. But Heidi Shireholtz, an economist at the Economic Policy Institute, argues that further unemployment benefits might have actually kept some of those 652,000 who left the labor market last month looking for jobs. When you're in a downturn like this, the logic gets flipped on its head, she explains. To receive unemployment benefits, you need to be looking for work. You are actually required to be looking for a job, whereas if you aren't getting unemployment insurance and there aren't any jobs, you might lose your incentive to look for work. Shireholtz says the June labor market report indicates that workers are dropping out once they exhaust their benefits or after months of fruitlessly searching for a job in an economy where five people are competing for every one opening, and most economists do not foresee unemployment dropping to a level below 8% for years. Even in a time of strong economic growth, there is lots of churn in the labor market and lots of people leave and later re-enter the labor force. There are plenty of good reasons to drop out, to go to school, or to take care of a relative, she says. But when it happens en masse during a period of labor market weakness, it is a further signal of weakness. The canonical example is someone who says, "I've knocked on every door in town 10 times. This is futile." And there is a lot of that happening right now. And she worries that next month, the statistics might be worse. Starting at the end of May, 300,000 people per week began losing their unemployment benefits due to congressional dithering on the extenders package, an unprecedented event, giving the sustained sky-high unemployment rate. The June unemployment survey took place too early to count most of them. Now, 1.7 million Americans have lost their unemployment insurance, and the survey will pick them up in the July numbers. By then, the question will be whether they will raise the unemployment rate or simply contribute to the tidal wave of people exiting the job market. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And continuing the second segment of the show, we have been for some period now studying the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke, by Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi. And there are some breakthrough solutions to the biggest crises families have faced, probably in America forever. The credit goes to Professor Warren and her daughter, because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on their work, theories, and books. I highly recommend their books, The Two Income Trap and All Your Worth. You can also revisit all of the shows that we have produced at the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt, and listen to the full story of dealing with debt. Last week, we were looking at the transitional time when the proposed bankruptcy law became active in the 90s to the time when Professor Warren and Amelia wrote this book and what happened up to the point of writing the book. For those of you who don't know, there is a bankruptcy law that had been basically written by the lending industry and lobbied strongly to Congress at a tune of nearly $80 million over a period of time in the late 90s. Professor Warren had looked at the reality of regulatory changes as an option to deal with America's crippling addiction to debt, specifically people getting embraced in debt offers when they weren't originally in the position to even be repaying those loans, which has happened in the last several decades. She felt regulation would curtail this result. And as proposals came up in Congress for regulatory change, the politicians didn't do anything about it. So at the turn of the century, the number of mortgage foreclosures skyrocketed, credit card debt soared, and the bankruptcy lines at the courthouse stretched out into the street and around the block, as she puts it. And all we heard from Washington was, at that time, the sound of silence. There was no serious program on any proposal to rein in predatory lending, no measure to control credit card fees, no proposal to ban creditors from trying to collect from a dead person's brother and sisters, which we've talked about in the past, and certainly no bill to bring back meaningful limits on interest rates up to that point. The national political parties had found time to take positions on the speed of the internet, ergonomic standards in the workplace, and regional restrictions on dairy products, but they claimed no position on the financial issues that profoundly affected millions of middle-class families. But they did do one thing. And with that inaction in the background, Congress paid attention to one troubling statistic: the rapidly growing number of families who were filing for bankruptcy. High interest rates and aggressive marketing of complicated debt products echo through the bankruptcy statistics as record numbers of families sought refuge in the bankruptcy courts after getting in over their heads with too much easy credit at exorbitant interest rates. So it started way back in 1994 when Congress created a bipartisan commission to study the issue. And just to repeat what we discussed last week, 3 years later, the commission delivered its report to Congress, a commission on which Professor Warren sat, called the National Bankruptcy Review Commission. So in 1997, they had an 1,100-page document which detailed why so many families were in trouble, job losses, medical problems, divorce, and identified certain lending practices that put families at a particular risk. More importantly, it reaffirmed that the bankruptcy laws were, for the most part, working as Congress had originally intended, to offer families a fresh start in the wake of financial and personal disaster. It concluded with recommendations for modest legislative changes that were designed to curb abuses by both borrowers and lenders. And as we said, there was a group called the National Consumer Bankruptcy Coalition on the other side of the issue. And this was really a clever moniker of the banking industry lobby, which was pushing its own agenda. And in essence, their agenda was, let's restrict the rights of consumers to file bankruptcy, and that'll help us deal with the problem. If fewer people could turn to bankruptcy for relief, more families would be subject to collection efforts from the banks and the creditor forever. So that was the goal of this whole thinking. That's when this bankruptcy law was drafted by the banking lobby, believe it or not. And the irony was that families might never pay off their bills in full with their thinking and efforts, but would continue to rack up interest and penalties, and at least a few would take some small payment every month, effectively becoming lifelong profit wells for the banks. For the rest, who simply could not come up with the money, no matter how hard they were squeezed, the lenders might eventually write off some of those loans voluntarily. But if they could set it up so the family were not permitted to file for bankruptcy, it would be the lender, not the family, in trouble, which would decide when the collection calls should stop. So the family really was disempowered totally. And of course, this went back and forth over the years as a bill that was being touted in Congress. And through the media and some miscalculations and mythical computations about what everyone would save due to the new bankruptcy law, the bill grew a lot of force behind it in Congress. As I mentioned, part of the irony was that some of the numbers that were being thrown out was that every family would save $550 in tax payments because of the so-called bankruptcies of mere convenience, which the rest of the people were theoretically paying for. So we'll get back to that in a minute. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we're talking about a bankruptcy law that was being drafted by the lending industry on the misconception that every family was going to be saving $550 in tax payments each year because of these bankruptcies that would be stopped. That certainly sounded good to people, and even the consumer bankruptcy lawyers had to stop for a while and go through the numbers. But when we break it down under the proposed bill, the fact is only 100,000 of the 1.5 million families who file for bankruptcy each year could afford to repay some of their debts. In other words, under that bill, those 100,000 bankrupt families would be expected to generate $550 for every household in America, since the other 1.4 million are already tapped out. So doing the math, when the law changed into what the lenders wanted, the 100,000 families could no longer seek protection from the bankruptcy courts, and they were forced to repay as much as they possibly could. But in order to return an amount that would add up to $550 for every household in America, each one of those bankrupt families would have to repay more than $550,000 in a single year. So in Professor Warren's sample of 2,000 bankrupt families, not one even owed $550,000, let alone earned enough money to repay that amount. So this is the kind of fabrication upon which the law was being founded. And even if that was actually a possibility, what makes anyone think that the banks would pass the money on to the consumers? Just for example, the credit card industry got a $10 billion windfall from falling interest rates in 2001, and they didn't pass that on to the customers. Why would they give $550 per family under this new law? So there was some intense lobbying back and forth. And at this point in time, Professor Warren goes on. She calls it Goliath meets David. And this is in about 2002, 2003. At that time, the cards were certainly stacked in favor of passing the banking industry's version of the bankruptcy bill in 2002. But it did not get passed. Who stopped that awful bill, as Hillary Clinton had termed it before she became a senator, but when she was the first lady? Later on, she actually voted for that awful bill. The answer to that question was that the credit industry and the congressional power brokers were defeated at that time by women. What prompted women to organize was not the financial issues in the pro-creditor bankruptcy bills, which were numerous, nor were they concerned over single mothers or women homeowners who would have been hit particularly hard if the bill had become law. Ironically, the issue that riled up women's groups was abortion. And this is how complicated bills become when they meet the congressional partisan debates. You would say to yourself, what does bankruptcy have to do with abortion? In Washington, it had a great deal to do with it. Over several years, just before this bill went to Congress in 2002, pro-choice groups had scored significant court victories against a few prominent abortion clinic protesters by obtaining money judgments against them, only to see those victories turn to dust when the protesters declared bankruptcy and discharged their debts. So in a strange twist of politics, the credit industry's version of the bankruptcy bill had been supported by Senator Charles Schumer of New York, who had garnered strong support among women's groups for his pro-choice politics. Again, this is back in the turn of the century. Ever responsive to his constituents, Senator Schumer inserted a provision into the bankruptcy bill that would make it more difficult for abortion clinic protesters to discharge judgments against them if they were sued for their protest activities, Much in the same way, drunk drivers and embezzlers cannot use bankruptcy to discharge judgments against them. Eager to appeal to women voters, the Senate had accepted the amendment in 2001. But in 2002, when the bankruptcy bill went back to the House with the abortion amendment in it, a coalition of Right to Life representatives refused to go along. They brought the bill to a standstill. Desperate to get the bill passed, the banking lobby went back to the Senate, pressuring Senator Schumer to remove the controversial abortion provision. Don't you just love politics? The industry ran attack ads against him in his home state, demanding that he support the bankruptcy bill and claiming that he was costing every American family $550 a year, which, as we just discussed, was completely absurd. Now, add to the irony, the attack on Senator Schumer was particularly wild because he had received more campaign contributions from the credit industry than any other senator, just nosing out fellow New Yorker Hillary Clinton at the time. And what happened back then was the pro-choice women's groups also mobilized, and they held firm, supporting Senator Schumer and threatening to withhold support from any elected official who moved to take the provision out of the bankruptcy bill. In one of those rare defining moments, Senator Schumer had to choose between big business and pro-choice women, both of whom had supported his campaign. He chose women, and the amendment remained in the bill. Ultimately, two strange bedfellows, a small group of socially conservative Republicans and a handful of progressive Democrats, gathered enough momentum to defeat the bankruptcy bill against the best financed lobbying campaign of the 107th Congress. So at that time, we did see a victory. And the real victors were the grassroots groups that successfully flexed their muscles against the most well-funded lobbying group in America, showing the world that even the credit industry can be defeated if key groups can be rallied against them. Professor Warren analyzes this at that time. What was the key to action? It was not simply a matter of putting forth the facts, as we have discovered is often the case in most of these congressional outcomes. Congress had already impaneled a bankruptcy commission to write an 1,100-page document filled with facts, which few even bothered to read. No, the real key was to match up the politics of financial distress with the interests of the rest of the country. The Right to Life organizations put a face on those who would be affected by Schumer Amendment, showcasing stories of elderly grandmothers and church-going families who protest abortion as a matter of conscience. The pro-choice organizations put their own face on the issue, spotlighting violent abortion protesters who had found a loophole that let them get away with breaking the law. So there is a big lesson here. To put sound economic policies on the political agenda, families also need to find a face. So long as they are debtors or bankrupts, their needs can be easily dismissed. Instead, they need to be seen as members of powerful constituencies, members of groups that command the respect and the fear of the political elite. Families in financial troubles must be depicted as they really are: parents of young children, non-resident fathers paying child support, suburban homeowners, African-American middle-class families, single mothers, families sending a kid to college, multi-generational Hispanic families. And most of all, the groups that defend these people need to organize against those who are picking their constituents' pockets, confident that they can get away with fleecing these families. And we will continue the story next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.